Yeah, I heard.
Actually, I found A to be wrong with B.
B, I think I thought B.
Language sometimes.
Well, B is a.
B would model our gossip.
Weird.
I thought B is a bit of a. No, that was just being written that recently.
Yeah.
So easy, what I spread out.
I remember two classes, I think, saying the other three, that's impressive. One, two, A, two, D, all through the easy, when they. I agree if you use. I'm just gonna say the same word.
Exactly, that's what I did.
Yeah, that's what I did.
Use language for some.
I think.
I'm fucking.
You shouldn't say the page.
I found it on YouTube.
I've seen that.
I looked at the.
I've seen that.
I did it. I did it the other way around.
But you can't print.
Yeah.
I think I probably go. I don't like watching videos, just move down. It's getting your board.
Yeah. I wanted to actually.
Well, because we can talk about push immigration.
If you go from.
Hi, I have a question about testing.
Yeah.
I'm having some huge problems coming up with unit tests for my projects, like pizza games, so it basically depends a lot on interactions between classes.
Right.
So, I looked a bit into it, and apparently a lot of people use a mocking framework for this.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with that.
Okay.
So that's another testing framework, is it?
No, it's kind of a thing that creates dummy objects of a certain class for you. And
oh,
then
right.
You integrate these into JUnit.
Right.
Like you say, okay, I create a dummy object of type soldier, whatever.
Yeah.
And you say, okay, and whenever soldier, this method is called in soldier, you should return this. And then
right.
You can test it like this.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay, so that's, I didn't actually go into this in the JUnit stuff. Are you familiar with the concept of fixtures in JUnit? No. So it's very common with unit tests to have some set of objects that get created before the test is run. It sounds like the kind of thing you're talking about. And then get thrown away when the test is over. And that's called a fixture. And there's typically, a particular method or set of methods that will construct those things before the test gets run. And JUnit has, some annotations and so on that will handle that sort of thing. So, I mean, what you're describing, the process of making some objects so that you can test effectively, that's perfectly fine to do. But are you saying you're finding it's too, that the whole setup is too complex to be able to do that effectively?
Kind of.
Yeah.
Because, I would have to create, it's very top-down, it's like a tree structure. So
right.
I would have to create
a
game and then this and then this and this and this and this only to test like a little part in one subcomponent of the AI of one enemy guy,
Yeah, 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 yeah. Well, what I'm looking for is some indication that you've tried to do some testing. So, I mean, if you can just do that for one little component and say, this is how I do it, obviously I don't have time to do a complete job on everything. And that's fine. That's fine. You don't need to kind of thoroughly test everything. Just do something reasonable. And just explain it. It's a lot of work to set all these things up. Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, let's get started. This sounds like this is working, right? No? Yes? How's that? Is that better? Yeah. Okay, good. Yeah, there aren't so many of you. I guess it must be that time in the semester when deadlines are hitting. Yeah. Monday. Is Monday the really bad day? Okay, well, what we're going to do today is go through... we're going to look at agile development processes, as I said last time, but to get set up for that, I just want to remind you of this waterfall model that we looked at last time that is kind of a straw man. It's not something that anybody actually really uses. But moving on from that, this idea of a set of, you know, you gather requirements, do design, do implementation, do verification, and then deployment and maintenance, that there's this kind of linear sequence. People came up with the idea of spiral models where you do multiple iterations of this. So that's kind of the jumping off point for for talking about agile processes. So what they were trying to deal with, the reason that people came up with this, the idea of doing these multiple iterations, is because they found that the software development process had to be kind of reactive. It wasn't something that you could kind of lay down in stone, we're going to, you know, first do this, then this, then this, then this, and then we're done. It was something that all along during the development process, you have to go back. You find things have changed that you didn't realize would change, and you have to go back. And so it's this ability to react quickly to change that really is behind the development of the agile approach to software development. So the agile approach is documented at, if you go to this website, you can see a whole set of principles. We're going to look through a little bit of that now. And you can, you know, read up, and if you're an aficionado, you can even sign up as a you know, card-carrying supporter of agile development. So the sort of generic statement is that they're trying to uncover better ways of developing software by doing it and helping others do it. And the core kind of values are four. So individuals, people, and their interactions are more important than processes and tools. This is you know, their statement. Software that's working is more important than documentation, complete documentation about what the software should do. It's much more important to collaborate with customers or users than it is to have a legal framework in which you're delivering to a contract. And responding to change is much more important than following a plan. And I think one of the things that is true in a lot of software engineering activities, and actually more generally in life, is that planning is a really good thing to do, but plans are pretty useless. So it's the thought process that you go through to create a plan that sort of stays with you and is useful in an ongoing manner. But any given plan is probably, you know, out of date very quickly. The military have a saying that no battle plan survives contact with the enemy. So, you know, they go into battle with this fantastic plan, and the minute they have the first interaction, they have to throw it out and, you know, generate a new one. And that's why wars are so chaotic. One of the reasons. Anyway, to get back to software engineering. So it's not the case that people who are following the agile methodology completely throw out tools and processes or documentation or contracts. You have to, if you're in a commercial environment, there has to be a legal framework. And they don't throw out plans. It's just that they regard these other aspects as more important. So that's really the message. And you can look at this in terms of kind of compare it with the waterfall model or even a spiral version of that. So You start with a set of features that haven't yet been done. You can think of this as kind of an ongoing process. It's not something where there's a beginning and there's an end. Well, obviously, there has to be a beginning, but conceptually, there isn't an end, and most of the time, you're somewhere in the middle. So there are things that you haven't yet done. You get select the ones that are most important, and then you go into this cycle of you do some planning, you make sure they're realistic plans, which basically means you're not going to project too far forward into the future because you just can't be sure about things, you know, very far forward in the future. There's a lot of communication, which helps to empower the team so that everybody knows what's going on and is involved in discussions and decisions. You produce working software quickly, and that feeds back the results of, you know, getting that out to customers, feeds back to doing more planning. And at the same time as you're going around this cycle, there are more unfinished features coming in. The customer said, oh yeah, there's this other thing we need now. So you're continually readjusting what's kind of feeding in at the top. So that's kind of the general agile idea. And so what we're going to do now is look at extreme programming, which is one of the variants. There are many, many variants of agile programming. The agile process, and extreme programming is one of them, and one that's very popular. So here's a statement of what the founders of extreme programming thought they were doing: a humanistic discipline of software development based on values of communication, simplicity, feedback, and courage. So courage is quite an important one there. So that's courage to sort of say no, we can't do that. Say no, that's not a realistic goal. Say no, that requirement is not as important as this other requirement. Say no, you know, I've worked 60 hours this week, I'm going home. Things like that. So that's the kind of courage that they're talking about there. And things like the courage to go back and say, oh, this piece of code I wrote was awful. I've got to refactor it. So, and these are some of the people who are involved. You know, you'll come, if you're in the software development world for long, you'll come across them. And again, there's a website you can look up more details about this essentially movement. So the basic problem is that large-scale software projects, one or more of these things often gets in the way of it being a successful project. So the schedule slips, and so the project gets cancelled, the system doesn't work properly, there's a very high rate of defects, you didn't understand what the business case was in the first place. False feature rich, you know, that's basically saying you're building in a lot of features that the customer didn't actually request defensively in case they might request it in the future. People come and go because they're not happy with the way projects are run. And just to give you a personal example of this, the software company that I deal with, over the years we've hired a number of software engineers, and many of them have said at one time or another, I spent years working for company X and nothing ever got delivered. So they actually built lots of systems or bits of lots of systems, but nothing ever actually got implemented in a customer environment. And you can imagine that that's a pretty dissatisfying situation to be in. You know, you've spent a year working on a system and then for reasons that are completely nothing to do with what you've done, it doesn't get out there. So that, you know, that's very demotivating, and this, you know, it results in quite a lot of staff turnover. So, you know, the extreme programming and the agile movement in general were partly to help deal with that. So one question is when is XP appropriate as a development process? And when requirements are changing or they're vague or you're just not very sure what they are, then it can be something worth looking at. There are projects where the requirements are clear and you know exactly what they are, and you know that they're not going to change. And in that case, the advantages of an XP, the XP kind of process, are mostly not appropriate. So that actually a more rigid kind of, first we'll get requirements, and then we'll do documentation, and then we'll do development, and so on, might be more appropriate. So it's not the case that one of these is always better than the other. You have to look at each situation. But it turns out that in the modern era, this kind of agile approach is much more appropriate. And you can see it, for example, in all the apps that we download and put on our smartphones. You know, whoever's developing is continually issuing updates. So one of the key insights of extreme programming is that the traditional processes are the way they are because the cost of coping with changing requirements goes up dramatically as time goes on through the development life cycle. So the idea was that, well, maybe it doesn't have to be that way. Maybe we can come up with a way that is more flexible. So it's designed to be flexible. And it's partly luck and you know, being in the kind of project where that's where you can do that, and it's partly judgment. So, you know, have you done enough refactoring, for example? And have you actually, is this a project where a more flexible approach is appropriate? So XP classifies the software development activities into four different areas. So there's coding, which we all know what that's about. Testing, we know what that's about. Listening is one that we haven't really looked at, but this is basically listening to feedback from the customers. What do the customers want? You know, really paying attention to what the users are going to want from the system. And designing, so continually designing. You don't sort of design and then say, okay, I'm done with that, I'm just going to build. You're continually going back and redesigning, and refactoring is a part of that. So it's quite interesting to take these four and think about, well, how do these apply if we go back to the waterfall model or a spiral version of it? You know, how do these compare with that? And obviously there are some aspects that are very similar, and they come in different amounts in different phases. So XP has a number of practices which are listed here. These are the standard XP practices, and we're going to go through each of these fairly briefly, what they are. So let's look at the planning game first. So this is the planning game's played with user story cards. So there are little cards with user stories. You remember what user stories are. Something that a user, the customer, has written down. I go to the system and I want to check my balance. You know, let's say it's a bank account or something like that. That's a little user story. Or I go to the system and I transfer some money from one account to another account. That's another little user story. So there are two games that, in the planning game, there are two kinds of games that are played. So one is the release planning game, and that involves the customer and the developers, and that's basically about what are we going to, what is going to be released. And then there's the iteration planning game, which is just the developers who are deciding what are the iterations, which may be more frequent, usually are more frequent than releases. And so in these games, the customer, their job is to bring the an understanding of the scope of the of these user stories and the project as a whole, particularly what is the priority, what's the business need for releases, and that can be related to particular commercial things that are going on with the company. And they sort these user story cards by priority. That's the traditional way to go. And the developers understand the risk, which means, and they understand estimating. So estimating how long it's going to take to, given it, say, a user story, what's it going to take to actually provide that capability in the system? And they understand the risk, meaning, if the estimate is, well, I can do that, I can get that into the system in 2 days. The risk is, well, how confident am I of that? Does 2 days mean, if I'm really fast, it might be 1.5, and if it really goes badly, it might be 2.5. That's a pretty tight window. Or does the risk mean, well, if it's great, I'll get it done in 5 minutes, and if it goes really badly, I've got absolutely no idea. So the developers, of course, are the people who have some estimate of that. And what you're trying to do in all of these things, again, is to minimize risk. So the developers, what they want to do is to sort the cards by risk, so that you do the low-risk things first. And of course, the way the customers sort the cards and the developers sort the cards is not going to be the same, very likely. And so there's a negotiation going on as to, okay, we'll put in this. The customer says, it's very high priority to put in this user story that is, the developers say, as well as a high risk. In which case, you're probably going to try and not put very many of those in to the iteration. And so this kind of game, it captures sort of whole system aspects of the problem. So for example, that you're not going to be able to get a release out any faster than the sum of all the different user stories that you're going to put into that release. So you don't start by saying, we want these a release out in 2 weeks, and we want to get 10 user stories into it. You might say we're going to do a release in 2 weeks, but then you have to chop off the set of user stories in the time available. And if there's risk involved, then you probably want to be conservative about that. So that's the planning game. I think I've mentioned this before. You need an on-site customer. So that's somebody who's capable of playing that role in the planning game, so making decisions for the customer in the planning game. And they sit with the development team, so the development team has access to them during normal working hours, whatever that is for this project. It doesn't mean that they're always working on the project, but they're there. So a developer can just turn around and say, can you elaborate on whatever it is? And they're always there to clarify. They help in writing tests, so they actually specify what some of the tests are. They probably aren't going to actually write the code for the tests, but they'll tell the developer, okay, this is what needs to be tested. And they make small scale priority and scope decisions. So if there's a user story that says, I want to be able to move money from one of my accounts to one of my other accounts, then the engineer who's working on that may in the middle of implementing it think, maybe there should be a limit on how much can be moved from one account to another. Maybe you don't want to let people move $100 million from one account to another without some sort of check, and they can just turn around to the customer and say, well, do you want to have a limit? So that's kind of small scale decision that wouldn't have gotten into the user story, but is important to have, but you don't realize it until you're actually implementing. So that's what the on-site customer does. And in some teams, the person who plays this role isn't actually employed by the actual customer. They're somebody who stands in for the customer. And they may be employed by the development, the company that's doing the software development. So it's not so much, who's employing them as are they capable of doing this? Of course, if it's somebody that comes from the development group somehow, then it's a more risky process, because you know you need to be confident that this person really is able to speak for the customer. So it probably means that they need to have gone and spent some time in the customer's sight before they can play that role. Releases in the XP framework are very frequent. You have to add some value in a release. So there's got to be something that makes sense business-wise for the customer. There are a variety of reasons for frequent releases, but one of the most important is that you get feedback. You don't get any feedback until you make a release. And the sooner you get feedback, the sooner you can make changes, the sooner you can correct things that you didn't get right the first time. Getting out frequent releases is a way of reducing the amount of re-engineering effort that you have to do because things weren't right the first time around. So that's a kind of a development benefit. There's also a benefit in terms of the customer gets the, because you prioritize functionality that's important to the customer, they're getting things that are important to them early. So they continue to be engaged in the process, and it's an essential part of delivering a successful project that you keep the customer engaged. Otherwise, you run the risk that they're going to cancel. So in XP, the sort of delivery cycle can be every week. Probably isn't going to be more than about a month. So every couple of weeks is quite common. And of course it can vary during the project, but it's those sorts of timeframes. Whereas in a more traditional kind of development process, 6 month releases are much more normal, or even less frequent than that. XP has this term metaphor, which is basically its term for what we think of as architecture. So they use a different word than architecture to emphasize that it's not just the structure of the system. It's meant to suggest that the metaphor captures some sort of larger scale coherence of what you know that can be talked about quite easily. So in a lot of cases will be more sensible than something that was purely couched in architectural terms. Continuous integration is another one of the XP practices. So code that's written is integrated into the code base right away, so within a few hours typically, or certainly within a day after it's written. We haven't talked about pair programming yet. We'll get to that in a minute. But when a pair of programmers want to checkpoint, to add in their code, they go to some integration machine, integrate their code into it, and then they run the tests and fix any bugs that come up. And so you've got a full build of the software system that's continually getting rebuilt, and the code changes are continually getting added in. Simple design, I think I've talked about this before as well. So the general agile phrase is, do the simplest thing that could possibly work, or another way of saying it is you're not going to need that. So don't think about what you're going to want tomorrow. Just think about what you need today and do that. Testing is fundamental, so you want to test everything you possibly can. You use a framework like JUnit, and the customers help with that. So the engineers can write tests of the classes as they understand them to work, but the customers can tell you about functional tests, like, for example, performance tests and that sort of thing. And refactoring is a key part of XP. So you constantly refactor. So one of, I think I may have mentioned this as well, one of the ways of deciding when to refactor is this idea of, three strikes and you refactor. So the first time you need a piece of code, you just write it. The second time you need the same bit of code, you kind of aren't too happy, but you just write it again. And the third time, you refactor it so that you share that bit of code between the two places, or now it's three places that are going to need it. So what this means is that you're not refactoring until there's some reason to believe that you actually do need to refactor, but you're refactoring fairly soon, fairly early, so you don't let things get way out of control before you're refactoring. So you know that you're only doing refactorings that are beneficial. Now, of course, how do you know whether you're duplicating code? Because maybe somebody else wrote that bit of code and you don't know that they did that. So it's not, this is easy to say, but it's not necessarily easy to do. And of course, you also need to actually have the permission to change the code to be able to do that. So for example, if somebody else made the same change that you did in another class, and even if you know about that, unless you can change the class they were working on, then you're not going to be able to refactor effectively. So ownership in common is also important. So pair programming is something that is, again, a standard practice in XP. How many of you have heard of pair programming? So a fair number of you. Okay. So the idea with pair programming is it's not that you're with the same, there are two of you, but it's not that you're paired with the same person, the whole time. You pair with different people and take each of the roles in the pair at different times. So there are two roles, and one pair who's got the keyboard and the mouse is thinking about how to implement right away, and the other person is thinking more strategically about, is this going to work, this whole approach that we're using, and what are some other test cases that might not work. So while the one person is writing test cases for all the obvious things, the other person is thinking about, what are some less obvious things that he might not think of. I have to say it's not something I've ever done myself, so I don't have personal experience of how this works, but people that I've talked to who have done it have said that it's actually a great way to work, although it might sound, if you've never done it, it might sound a bit weird, but people who have used it are very enthusiastic about it. Okay, so collective ownership, I mentioned that. In XP, there isn't really the concept of a bit of code that you own, a bit of code someone else owns. Everybody has access and is able to change any bit of code. And of course, you need good tools to support that, good configuration management tools to support that. You need to have coding standards. I mentioned before, if you don't have coding standards, then it can become hard to read code because the different people have worked on. And that's especially true with XP because there is this ownership in common and because there's, often, very frequent commits of code changes. So coding standards are really important to make pair programming work. I mean, if the two people in the pair are using different standards, it's just going to interfere with them communicating with each other while they're working together. Sustainable pace is very important, and this is one of the kind of non-technical but more people-oriented aspects of XP. You all know that it's very easy to, when deadlines approach, pull all-nighters and this kind of thing. But doing that kind of thing occasionally is there's nothing wrong with it. But it's not the kind of thing that you can do on a routine basis and work effectively. So this was kind of built into the XP framework, so that managers would understand that, you know, it's, you're not going to get what you want if you push people too hard. So those are the the XP practices, and you should, you know what that list is and a little bit about what each one is. Some people, so that's a very specific agile methodology. And of course, some of those practices are used in other related methodologies. And some of them are used in standard development methodologies, and testing is something that's used in pretty much all of them. So sometimes people try to pick and, you know, mix and match, so sort of pick some practices from XP and use some practices from elsewhere. And you know, you can do that, but you have to be very careful about making sure that what you pick works with the other things you're doing. So for example, if you're using doing collective ownership, anybody can, everybody has access to all the code to changing it, but you're not using coding standards, then, you know, that's just a recipe for a mess. If you do simple design, so that is to say, you know, you don't design for tomorrow, you design for today, but you don't refactor frequently, then you're just going to end up with a very unwieldy code base. And XP is applicable in lots of different situations, and it's the sort of thing that you can have a discussion about is, you know, should we use an XP approach for this particular project or should we not? And it's not really very easy to come up with a set of rules or criteria by which you can decide. One way is to say how clear are the requirements and how likely do we think it is that they're going to change? On the one end, if you think the requirements are not clear and they're probably going to change, then XP is probably going to be good. And at the other end, a more traditional approach would be good. But you know, most projects fall somewhere in the middle. So it's not always obvious. But there are lots of documented cases of XP working. It worked, for example, in Chrysler for a big custom software project they did in-house. Microsoft used to use XP, it didn't seem like it would work for them. I mean, they used to do software releases, very infrequently, and people didn't like their, software updates because it was a lot of work. But now, and you probably don't remember that time, but 10 or 15 years ago, that was the case. And but now, we have, nightly downloads of software updates for Microsoft software, and Microsoft is sponsoring Agile. So these things change over time, and my impression is that the Agile methods are probably gaining a larger share of the overall software engineering effort around the world. Although there remain very big, large, very big projects that for which it's not appropriate and for which lots of people are needed. Okay, so I think that's all I want to say about XP, but the other thing I would like to do is give you, in the 10 minutes or so remaining, give you a little questionnaire. It's just a few questions about how the course has been going. And if you could fill these out, and you don't put your names on them, so it's all anonymous. And then I'll collect them at the end. Or if you prefer, you could hand them into the ITO. But as I say, it's all anonymous. So there's no particular need to do that. So if I give you a few here. sure I've got enough.
So I'm just going to wait by the exit, and you can either hand them to me as you go out, or if you want to be even more anonymous, just leave them.
Thank you. I